Friday, the first session of the House State Affairs Committee for this, I believe, 27 legislature will please come to order. Welcome, everybody. Clerk, would you please call the roll?
Representative Wilson, not present. Representative Seaton?
Present.
Representative Keller?
Here.
Representative Grunberg, not present.
Representative Grunberg is excused. He's ill.
Thank you. Representative Peterson?
Present.
Representative Johansson?
Yes, present.
Chair Lynn?
Present, and Representative Wilson is present. Okay, with that, we're going to get started, but at the first of every State Affairs Committee meeting for a new legislature, I'll tell people about this. And this is a very special gavel. I was raised by my maternal grandparents. My grandmother, Edna Lynn, she didn't have very much schooling, but when she, in her late 60s, almost 70, she graduated, went to school, and graduated, and got her high school diploma. And during that process, she was awarded this gavel for the most improved student in her class, and it has her name on here, and says most improved student. So every meeting that I've ever had in which I used a gavel, this is a gavel I use. It's a very special gavel to me, and I'm very proud to use it in her name, and it sounds pretty good, doesn't it? So our first bill, we have two bills to hear this morning. I guess we have HB 21, Suicide Prevention, Council Members, and HB 14. Depending on the will of the committee, I would like to move HB 21 this morning. HB 14, the prime sponsor is not here. I need to find out at this point, where's the staff of Representative Grunberg?
Right there.
Are you going to be presenting this without Representative Grunberg, or do you want to hold off on it? I didn't hear you.
Would it be possible to present it this morning and then hold until Thursday?
Yes, that would. Yes, we can. So you'll be presenting that?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. You'll be second on the agenda. Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, would the sponsor, please, for HB 21, please come forward? And I guess before you start, I meant to do this anyway. I'd like to welcome folks to the House State Affairs Committee. We have mostly veterans of the committee here this morning. So let's go right down. Representative Peterson, do you have anything you'd like to say at the first committee meeting here?
Well, it's just good to be back. We made some very great decisions, I think, in this committee over the last 2 years, and hopefully we'll be able to continue that tradition.
Very good. Glad to have you back. Representative Seaton?
Well, thank you. This is an exciting committee with a diversity of topics that come to it, so I'm pleased to be here.
It's a good committee. Going to start down the other end. Representative Johansson?
Mr. Chairman, I think I'm happier than anybody to be sitting on this. And like Representative Seaton said, we get so many bills and so many different topics in this committee. That's why it was my favorite committee when I was a freshman. We touched a lot of stuff in here.
Well, and you've been on my committee before, and you've done an outstanding job on my committee before, and I know you're going to continue that, and I really do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Emily Wilson.
Thank you very much. I just look forward to what we're going to be seeing in the form of bills, and if they're good bills, maybe we can make them better and move them out. So thank
Great.
You.
And a newbie on the committee, Representative Keller, vice chair this time. Do you have any comments you'd like to make?
Well, just thank you. I look forward to working with all of you on these bills, and I anticipate that we'll have a good working relationship. And, yeah, my only experience here on State Affairs has been out there where they're sitting. And so this is
Did you pass any of your bills? I don't remember.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, okay. You are treating me pretty good. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman, committee members. Representative Fairclough, District 17, Eagle River, Alaska, and Representative Berta Gardner, Midtown, Anchorage District 24.
Members of the committee, Representative Gardner and I both serve on Alaska's Suicide Prevention Council, representing the House of Representatives. I'm not sure if you're aware, but Alaska experiences suicide at a rate of twice the national average. In Alaska, 15 to 24-year-olds have the highest rate of suicide. This is troubling, and one reason why Representative Gardner and myself have committed our time over the last 2 years to actually attend meetings for the Suicide Prevention Council and try to move strategic planning forward in that planning committee. Suicide is one of the top 10 causes of death in Alaska. It's on page 11 of the strategic plan that you can take a look at some of those numbers. On page 20, we talk about what Representative Gardner and the council is trying to move forward, and that is a public health model emphasizing community readiness and planning efforts, as well as outcome to look at prevention strategies locally and to find a local fit geographically for each town and community. With that, over the course of meeting many times over the last 2 years, Representative Gardner and I have collaborated with the blessing of all committee members to bring forward to you a bill, House Bill 21, and I'll let Representative Gardner go over the two things that House Bill 21 does.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for hearing this bill so promptly. We think it's a critical issue and we need to move forward with as quickly as we can with some of the issues. The bill before us comes from our most recent Suicide Council meeting, and we have two suggestions to improve the effectiveness. Number one, in the full awareness that suicide is a big problem among military active duty and retirees, and a growing problem, we thought we should have somebody on the council who can bring experience dealing with that issue from the military perspective. The way the bill is drafted, it could be somebody who is currently in service, including Coast Guard and the other elements, but also could be a retiree, or somebody who not necessarily, if we can't find someone who's willing and able to serve in that capacity, somebody who has worked with military people in public health or counseling or something like that. We just want to have somebody who's knowledgeable and has firsthand experience working with suicide.
And I believe you made some modifications on that for a CS. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. And at this point, I'd like to ask somebody to move the CS.
Mr. Chair, I'd move version Bravo, that's LS0154 Bravo, as the working document of blank CS.
Thank you. With no objection, we'll work with the CS. Continue, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The second element of the bill addresses our youth member. Historically, the youth member has been in 9th, 10th, 11th, or 12th grade. What we have found actually happens is they're generally appointed at 10th or 11th grade, and they come to a meeting or two meetings, and then they graduate, and they're gone. And it takes a little while to really get your feet under you and know what we're dealing with and to be comfortable speaking out and things like that. So we thought it would be better if instead of going with a grade, we went with an age and moved the age up to age 20 so that somebody who has graduated from high school but is just getting really comfortable with serving on the council would still be able to participate. And we believe that somebody who's 19 or 20 years old is still qualifies as a youth member, particularly as most of us are moving the other way faster and faster. So that's the two changes that the bill would make.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, for the public record, Mr. Chairman, when I came to your office, you noted and pointed out that we did not understand the full meaning of active military members. So the CS before you incorporates changes that the chairman suggested in our ability to include National Guard, which was always our intent, but not what legal had provided for us. So the CS version, what the modification is for your edification, is a change so that it's inclusive more in a more broader perspective. So we thank the chairman for that improvement to the
Well, the thing is, National Guard, of course, works for the state, but then when they're federalized by the president for any other purpose, then they don't work for the state anymore. They work for the federal government. So we want to get a voice from all branches of the military. Let me ask a question, please. It's all over the net, all over the newspaper, of course, the horrific situation with domestic violence and rape and so on. highest in the nation, and it's been grossly underreported. What's the relationship, if any, between domestic violence, sexual abuse, and suicide?
Mr. Chair, if I may, Representative Gardner, my view, and this I'm not necessarily speaking for the council, is that despair, depression, whether it comes temporarily through alcohol abuse or whether it comes from years of being a victim and living in a bad situation, it's all tied in together, and it's hard to tease out exactly which threads lead to which behaviors. But there's no doubt that Alaska has leading numbers in all of those areas: alcohol abuse, domestic violence, sexual assault, and suicide. And it's my belief that they are all interrelated.
It would seem to me that if we can do something to improve the, again, horrific situation with sexual child abuse, domestic abuse, all varieties of it, that would have a significant impact on suicide prevention.
Mr. Chairman, I'd refer you to page 10 of the Mending the Net Suicide Prevention in Alaska annual report. 33% tested, 33% of those tested that had followed through on suicide, completed suicide, tested positive for drugs or alcohol, 44% for alcohol, 48% for other drugs. Also, if you go through the report, nationally, there's a relationship between poverty, which is what, and depression. What Representative Gardner is alluding to is that when there is a lack of hope inside of an individual community, that there's despair and a feeling that people are trapped inside that particular environment, and not a recognition that tomorrow's a new day and that there are new opportunities existing in that day if you just choose to wait for that sun to rise. And
I imagine lack of hope is almost a definition of suicide, I would think.
Well, I hope not, sir, but there is certainly a tie to it, so there's many related behaviors.
Any questions or comments from the committee? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I very much appreciate the suicide prevention efforts that are in here, and you know, the questions we're looking at, despair and all, and one thing that appears to be is that we are looking at suicide prevention mostly just before it happens, suicide call hotlines and all those. And you know, we're having another initiative. We'll be having hearings in Hess on looking at a prevention model for diseases. And one of the things that we'll be looking at in there is vitamin D and its relationship to seasonal affective disorder, and that it's, you know, basically the most effective treatment we've had is just having people's vitamin D level high enough and to reduce that, and much more effective than light therapy. And so one thing that we know is that Alaska and the far north here has some of the lowest levels of vitamin D in the nation, and we also have the period of the longest night. And so seasonal affective disorder is here. And so I look forward to working with council in the future on other ways of lowering that seasonal affective disorder, depression, and those kind of things. And so I really appreciate the report. I'm supportive of the bill, and I hope the Suicide Prevention Council looks more broadly, and I've had conversations with Representative Fairclough on this, and I'm appreciative of that, and I think that we're going to jointly move forward at looking at these things. So I appreciate the council looking at prevention very much.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just really pleased that you're adding on a military person, and I hope you can get someone that has at least some experience working with some of the people as they come back. You know, my heart really goes out to the military with, you know, they're risking their lives, and some of them giving their lives for us. And anything that we can do to help them is wonderful. And I've across from page 10, page 9, was, you know, we've got a lot of people going into the military at a pretty young age, and when they come back, they're, you know, 23, 24. That's right in the highest age group right there. But I also was, I just hadn't thought that the other highest age is 85 and above. And, you know, I was just kind of shocked about that. So anyway, I'm very, very much for this bill, and it's something that all of us want to see make. We all want to make a difference, and if this is one way we can, we definitely need to do it. And I'm ready to make a motion if someone else is.
Yes, Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would be remiss if I didn't just highlight for Alaskans that in 2009, 140 individuals committed suicide. And since we began accumulating numbers between 2000 and 2009, 1,369 Alaskans chose to take their own lives. That's an incredible impact on communities. And while Anchorage experiences the most completed suicides, as far as the ratio goes, rural Alaska by far exceeds urban Anchorage or urban area numbers. And so please don't take an individual number in this report. You need to cross-tab almost everything that we're doing, as Representative Seaton pointed out, to look at this particular issue, because it is a point of despair. And page 9 in the report really does show that children that are reaching adolescence are becoming prone to that, and then our elders are experiencing despair and hopelessness, or possibly facing life-limiting diseases that they're taking matters into their own hands. So it's a task that Representative Gardner and I are honored and humbled to be part of, but we need your help. And I just would point out that there's a $4,000 fiscal note. That's so we try to pick a rural community once a year, try to participate. Sometimes last year it was twice, but we try to get out into rural Alaska specifically because those particular communities are experiencing rates anywhere between 2 and sometimes 6 times the national average, depending on the community.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to add a couple things. Firstly, when we talk about suicide numbers, there may be others that we don't know are suicide. You know, somebody who freezes to death, a 14-year-old recently, I don't know anything about that case, but that kind of thing could also be a suicide that isn't included in our numbers. And secondly, I think the value of the Suicide Council going to rural Alaska and hearing the stories, we have public meetings and people do come and tell us their own experiences and those of family members and schoolmates and such, is not only what we learn, but that things that people have traditionally not talked about, they're learning to talk about in public so that even after we're gone, they can have discussions and more awareness in and amongst themselves, and the taboo topics come up, and we think that that can be very healthy.
Is there a common denominator among suicides in bush communities that's different than the common denominator in urban areas, if you follow me?
Mr. Chair, I don't exactly know how to answer that. I would say off the cuff that I think there are more young people in rural Alaska, but that's a guess. I'm not speaking from known statistics. The common denominator simply is despair and the idea of taking it, that people don't realize that things, as Representative Fairclough said, can be better another day. And so it's sort of taking a permanent solution to something that can be a temporary problem and just not seeing that it can be temporary. And I guess that's the definition of despair.
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Yes, Representative Fairclough.
Fairclough, page 8, suicide and ethnicity. Suicide rates among Alaska Native people are higher than any other ethnicity in the state and are the highest in the United States. So Alaska Natives have a higher rate of suicide than anywhere in the nation. And I'm not finding a specific the point, but I'm sure that I read boys in rural Alaska. I think that percentage goes way up. a feeling of despair. A lot of the younger suicides, at least when we listen to community members in rural Alaska, are talking about young men or young women who are experiencing first love or relationships that they feel will last a lifetime, and when they don't, they're not equipped. Representative Gardner, I hope that's fair. They're not equipped to handle the devastation of losing that partner, and so it goes back to what Representative Seaton was saying. What are we doing earlier in the game to provide asset-building skills so that people can stand on their own and know that if this particular person rejects you, it doesn't mean that your life should be over, that you should learn from those experiences and take them into your next relationship so that you can assess what you're doing, doing and what you want out of life. And so really it's a conversation about life early on and how precious that life is. And what is so extraordinary out in rural Alaska is that we have village elders that are at the table pouring their hearts out and asking youth to stop, to step back and say that they care about them, to start working differently between creating a youth and an elder relationship inside individual communities. So it really is amazing, and I know that the council inside of this particular report is saying if we've done nothing else, it's the year of Alaska starting to talk about, specifically rural Alaska, to start talking about suicide and the tragedy that people who have to carry on after the suicide, the load that they carry in the hole that's left in their heart when a youth...
So there's more than one victim.
Oh, the whole communities are victims. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Keller?
Yeah, first I just want to say thanks for your work on the council. I know that it's a lot of work. It's above and beyond what I think many realize, you know, and I just appreciate it. And I appreciate you bringing this bill and, you know, being a vehicle for the legislature to learn and pick up. I just want to say thanks. But the question I have is on page 16, it shows the rate of suicide per population. And it generally, as you go north, the higher the rate, if I understand it right. And then on page 20, it shows the funding, and the funding doesn't follow the rate. And I was just wondering if you had comments on that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, money is not the only answer, but this report does not track all money coming in. So we can't say definitively, but certainly when I read the report, it was spotty on whether you invested money in a particular community, whether it actually made a difference in talking about suicide. What we are finding makes a difference is the elders engaging with the youth and trying to do that. And so when I talked about the public health model, we're talking about now investing from a behavioral health standpoint in communities to see if they're ready to talk about the issue and they're ready to engage with their community at a low level. We're not coming to you today asking you for investment of hundreds of dollars for prevention. What we're trying to do with the money that the state has allocated is create a synergy inside of communities so that they bring all resources to the table, a very small amount from the state, but have tribal interaction, Bureau of Indian Affairs, the local governments themselves to take on that responsibility, because if we've seen anything, we've seen that one size does not fit all and that what's happening in individual communities are unique to that community.
Excuse me, go ahead.
If I might just add one thing. One of the things that's been really interesting about traveling around Alaska and listening to people talk about this problem is that there are some communities where people seem to be waiting for somebody to tell them what to do about this. But there are other communities that are just adamant and who say, we know this is our problem, and we know that we have the solutions right here in our community. We need to figure out how we harness what we already know and use it effectively to help address this problem. And so, as Representative Faircloth says, it isn't always a matter of money. I mean, money can help us train people how to respond. Money helps us have resources like the CARE line and have it staffed and have people really knowledgeable about how to help people who call in. But there's a lot of work that can be done that's local, and what we hope to be is something of a gathering point for that, that after we've been there and listened and people have heard each other, that work goes on when we're gone.
Thank you. Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm on page 12 of the annual report. And my question has to do with the graph that's presented, the percentage broken down by census area. And this may be a gotcha question, so I'm not, you know, trying to catch you, but is some of these areas, they vary from Wrangell-Petersburg 1.4%, which is very good. Ketchikan area 3.7%, all the way up to 13, 14, 9, 8, depending on the area. Are there areas in the state, like, say, Ketchikan at 3.7%, that reflects what the nationwide average is? Are there areas where we're on par with what the United States is, and other areas which are the real problem spots? What's the average across the country?
Mr. Chairman, I can get that. I read that last night, actually. We do have it, Mr. Chairman, Representative Fairclough, I apologize. We do have those national average. Some of the urban areas are a little bit closer to national average, but certainly rural Alaska doesn't come anywhere close. The 3% might be in the range. I'd have to look at the per capita, but there is a graph in here. Kate, I don't know if you can help me. I know I read it last night. Page 50. No, that's not the one.
That's okay. Mr. Chairman, I didn't mean to put the sponsors on the spot, but just the concept that certain areas of our state are statistically similar to what we see across the country, and some areas are particularly troublesome. Obviously, that's pretty obvious to all of us here in Alaska. So in your experience on the board, there must be a concentrated effort on those particular areas. And what kind of I don't know the people on the board, so what kind of impact, influence do those particular rural areas? I know Representative Salmon was a member over the last 2 years. Do you know if there's been a replacement for Representative Salmon yet? And how do those areas get into the conversation, because I don't know who's on the board, obviously.
Through the chair, I'm not quite sure how to answer it, because the board isn't comprised of people representing certain districts. We're rather representing, and actually it's in statute who our membership is and certain seats. So, but we do have members from different parts of the state, and our perspective, quite simply, is that one suicide is too many, and we will continue trying to get the numbers down everywhere, regardless of what the national average is.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, Representative Fairclough, there are people serving on our board from the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, the Alaska Mental Health Board, the Alaska Federation of Natives, a counselor or someone from secondary school, someone, a youth, someone who's experienced a death by suicide, someone who resides in a rural community not connected by roads, a member of the clergy, and a person who's under the age of 18. More specifically, Megan Crow from the Bethel region serves. She's a school teacher, so she's in the schools and actually can see the despair that's happening there, so we have that perspective on the board. Phyllis Carlson, Department of Education, is there. Athabaskan from the southeast area by heritage. We have Barbara Franks. I'm not sure where her hometown is, but works for.
She lives in Anchorage.
She lives in Anchorage now, but she worked for the Alaska Native Consortium. Pastor Lowell Sage.
Is he from Bethel? Bethel region?
Kotzebue, up from the Kotzebue area. Alana Humphrey down in the Homer area, I believe. Nurse?
Alana.
Sharon Norton's a nurse from the Homer area. So we have a geographic diversity as well as different expertises on the board. And recently, one of the reasons why the board is running more effectively now is that we've merged resources with the Mental Health Trust, and Kate Burkhart has taken over as the executive director, and we actually have dedicated staff now, which is the first time in the 3 or 4 years that Representative Gardner and I have been following this issue, that we actually have a staff person that's able to meet the needs of the council and try to help move that ball forward in talking about issues and strategic planning. So we are planning a meeting here, and you will see council members in your office next week, January 30th through February 2nd. Representative Gardner and I will be attending as many strategic planning sessions as possible over those 2 days to try to look at actual prevention strategies for communities in Alaska.
Thank you. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering, has the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council looked at what other nations are doing in, from northern climates to see what they may have found to solve the suicide question in their country or in their northern regions? Or have there been any studies like that you know of, or other, like the Scandinavian countries or something?
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, this is Representative Gardner. We have not in a systematic way examined what other places are doing, but I think there are people looking at what we're doing, because certainly nationally, since we lead the nation, and you know, there's a concern here.
Something we don't want to be a leader in.
Exactly.
My goodness. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I do want to mention something on page 12. The numbers in that graph are based on 2000 to 2008 census data, and for my, and it looks like my community is doing fairly well, but just last month we had 2 suicides in my community. So it's, you know, even when we have data that we can get, we definitely have some problems, and So I'm just really pleased to, if it's all right with you, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion.
I'm going to reserve your motion, because I have somebody else who'd like to testify. And then after that, I'll happily entertain a motion. Do we have Kate Burkhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kate Burkhart. I have been the director of the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council since July, when the council co-located with the Alaska Mental Health Board and the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. I am here today because our chairman, Bill Martin, sends his regrets. He could not be here today due to some family obligations out of town. The council not only supports the bill, but is extremely grateful for the work of the sponsors, Representatives Faircloth and Gardner, who have not just come to meetings, but have been active and provided leadership, and we are very grateful for that. An element of the bill that has not been discussed is that it is a direct reflection of the council's commitment to not just including the public in limited public comment and then leaving and doing whatever the council wants to do, but in responding to what people tell us. The council met in Fairbanks during the Alaska Federation of Natives convention in October and heard from a representative from the military healthcare system about interest and need for a military representative on the council. And that's where this comes from. The council members, Representatives Faircloth and Gardner, represented at the Bethel listening session hosted by Senator Murkowski, also in October last year. One of the things that we heard was very passionate input from young people, and I think that reinforced the fact that we have not had the benefit of consistent input from young people. When we have a young person that has been seated, the time we have with them is wonderful, but by the nature of the way the statute is written right now, it's often very limited, and council members wanted consistently to have that voice of young people, and felt that this was a good way to do that. So I just want to reinforce that there is a commitment by members of the council to be a little bit different. When we go out and listen, we actually act on what we hear, and we feel accountable to the people of Alaska. And the sponsors are helping the council show that accountability through this bill.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. And we have another, I believe, Judy Bachman from Anchorage. Are you here, please, or online?
Yes, Carolyn, I'm online, but I'm here to testify with respect to HB 14.
Okay. We will hold you for that one. Anybody else in the audience who would like to testify? If not, any discussion from the committee? Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really appreciate the engagement and working together ideas that have been brought forward here. And one thing that I would like to point out is that, you know, I'm very happy that we're talking about a young person being more effective in this process. And one of the things that hopefully we can look at in coordination with the Education Committee, I know Representative Dick has brought a lot of energy from rural Alaska, and one of the things that we've seen in graduation rates and everything else is that our education system is not engaging students in relevant learning. It's teaching them things to leave the village, but are they adequately prepared to leave the village, or do we need to make sure that the education is relevant to as they're growing up and prepare them for a diversity of choices that they can make? So I think that this despair portion, we need to look with the council as well as the education committee and the education community is to that engagement and eliminating that despair by having education relevant to the students. And so I think that we have another source of coordination there that might be helpful, and I appreciate the bill. Thank you.
That's an interesting point. Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I think these are really good changes, and I appreciate the sponsors continuing the work of Senator Halford, who had the initial legislation to create this back in 2001, and I think it's a really good entity. Specifically to the changes, the first one under J, switching it out from a grade 9 through 12 and extending that. You know, when kids get out of high school, that's a really interesting time in their lives, and a lot of decisions need to be made. And I think extending that out to 20 really was going to be helpful. That's a time when a lot of young people are like, what am I going to do? And there's a lot of despair, I think, during that time for a lot of people. That's a big life change. Do I go to college? Do I go to trade school? Do I work for the local company? Do I leave the state? And it's tough. So I think that's a really good change, covering that out a couple years. And then Representative Wilson talked about the military. You know, I have a Coast Guard base in my community, and we've got some of the big ones in the country spread across, and the one in Sitka in your district and in Kodiak. And the obvious connection to the military base is up in Representative Faircloth's district and the state. Really good idea, very supportive, and I appreciate the work that both representatives have done on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased that you brought this legislation before this committee. Representative Wilson, do you have a motion to make?
Yes, thank you. I move CS for House Bill number 21, version B, moved out of committee with individual recommendations, and the accompanying fiscal note.
Okay. Without objection, this bill is moved. I want to thank you again very much for bringing the bill before us, and I would like to invite anybody on the committee to co-sponsor the bill. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Mr.
Our next bill on the agenda is HB 14, Executive Ethics, Legal Fees, Family Travel. So who are you going to be presenting that? Or somebody? Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Gretchen Staft, and I am the legislative aide for Representative Max Gruenberg. Representative Gruenberg sends his apologies that he couldn't be here today. He intended to, but I'll be presenting the committee today, and we have some folks on the line that can answer questions. Certainly, if there's questions left over that we can't answer for you today, feel free to hold the bill till Representative Gruenberg can be here to answer your questions.
And we'll follow through on this at the closest opportunity.
Sure. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, House Bill 14 largely puts in statute what the Attorney General's executive ethics regulations recently put forth in December when they were enacted. There is some question, however, about whether some topics in those regulations were within the scope of the authority of the Attorney General to enact. So, and regardless, even if it was within the scope of their authority, there could be an appearance of impropriety because it is essentially the executive branch creating rules on what the executive branch can or cannot do. So this bill basically provides a correction to that, eliminates the appearance of impropriety, and also fixes two problems which Representative Gruenberg picked up in those regulations, which I will get to when I go through the bill. Feel free to stop me at any point with any questions. I'll just go through the bill section by section. I think that's the best way to illustrate what the bill does. The bill basically deals with family travel and the payment of legal fees for defending executive ethics violations. Section 1 of the bill, if you turn to page 2 on line 10, you can
page
see there's...
Page 2, line 10.
There is a stylistic change that just changes partisan political purposes to a partisan political purpose. And then following that on lines 14 through 23, it deletes the definition of for partisan political purposes and then just moves that to a later section of the bill, which is on starts on page 3, line 30. Section 2 of the bill just makes a conforming change in keeping with the changes in section 1, changes partisan political purposes to a partisan political purpose. Section 3 is where we get to the main, first part where we get to the main substance of the bill. This section of the bill authorizes the use of state funds to pay for families of the governor and lieutenant governor to travel to certain events. And so when I say families, I mean the spouse of the governor or lieutenant governor or a child. And this is one section where our bill differs from the recently enacted regulations. We have a different definition of child. In the regulations, they define child to mean basically a minor child. We expanded that definition slightly to include not only minor children, but children of the governor and lieutenant governor who may be a little bit older, but due to a mental or physical disability, are dependent on the governor or lieutenant governor for their daily care. Representative Gruenberg just thought that was fair, and that just because somebody turned 19 or 20, that didn't mean that they were no longer dependent, and that the lieutenant governor or governor can more easily just pick up and leave. So the circumstances under which it's okay to use state resources to pay for family travel is one, if the governor or lieutenant governor travels with the family and then reimburses the state for that, that's fine. And the other circumstance is if the person's attendance is a benefit to the state. And you can see starting on page 3, lines 15, those situations in which the attendance is seen to be a benefit to the state are enumerated. So that's one, if a person's attendance at the event is required for official action of the state. Two, the event is state-sponsored and the person's attendance has been customary at similar events. Three, the person is attending as an officially designated representative of the state. Or four, the person is invited by the sponsor of the event before the transportation occurs, The event is related to issues important to the state. The governor, lieutenant governor attends, and either it's a youth event or something like that where the person's attendance is particularly appropriate, or the invitation and the person's attendance have been customary for similar events. And when this bill was heard last year in this committee, I believe we made some minor tweaks to that, but that is essentially the same as in the regulations. And then following that is just the definition of partisan political purpose, which we've already gone over. In section four, we cover the legal fees and costs of executive branch employees who are accused of ethics violations. This section would authorize the state to reimburse only after exoneration an executive branch employee who was accused of an ethics violation. And this is different from the regulations in that the regulations authorize the state to pay the ongoing legal fees of an employee before that employee is exonerated. Representative Gruenberg just thought it was better policy to wait and make sure that the person was indeed exonerated before the state put forth those fees that were used in the defense. The rest of the section is substantially similar to the regulations in that the funds can only be put forth by a state agency that may lawfully put forth that payment. And it also defines exoneration on page 4, lines 22 through 29. We wanted to clarify that when we say exonerated, that means that the complaint has been entirely dismissed or resolved solely with a recommendation for preventative action. We're not talking about corrective action here. That's not exoneration. So only in these circumstances, if it's dismissed or resolved solely with preventative action, can the person be reimbursed their legal fees and costs. And there's also a requirement that these fees and costs be reasonable in the amount and necessarily incurred in the defense against the claim. And section 5 just clarifies that this bill applies only to complaints that are initiated or filed on or after the effective date of the act. So it's certainly not retroactive. That's the gist of the bill. I am happy to answer any questions that you might have had along the way, or we can.
I have one question, and you probably don't have the records. I don't know if you could get them, but in previous situations where the governor or the lieutenant governor has had to defend themselves with legal counsel, I know it depends on the case, depends on the charges, the circumstances, but how much money are we talking about to defend yourself if you're the lieutenant governor or governor against some kind of ethics violation and you're later exonerated?
Mr. Chairman, I do not know the answer to that question. I can certainly do some research for the next hearing, or perhaps Judy Bachman from the Department of Law might be better suited to answer that, but I'll certainly look into it.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 4, lines 11 through 13, where it says, when a complaint has alleged more than one violation against a public officer or a firm of public office, payments may be apportioned by alleged... payments may be apportioned by alleged violation. So... I'm unclear if that means, let's say there's three charges in at one time. One is very technical and small, and the others are quite serious. And if the and one may take very little defense or whatever. Does this set out that they'll be done by, if you're exonerated on two of the three counts, it's two-thirds, or is this by the amount of defense required or apportioned between there? is that apportionment by lawyers? I'm unclear what it means.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I believe how that would work is certainly the attorneys for the employee have to keep detailed records of how they spend their time, excuse me, when they're working on the case. So they should have records of their hourly expenditures on each issue that they are working on, each complaint that's filed against the employee. So if the person is exonerated of two-thirds of the claims, if they're, you know, if three were brought against them, two were dismissed, then that person could recover from the state whatever legal fees and costs were incurred in the defense of those two claims that were brought against them. So we are putting the burden on the employee and his legal counsel essentially to show when the fees were incurred, what they were incurred for, and so they will have to show that the legal fees that they're seeking reimbursement for were indeed the fees incurred for the complaints that were dismissed.
Follow up.
Thank you. I am unclear that this wording spells that out well enough to put in statute, and I would appreciate it if you would check and see, because I can see a place where there's a single complaint filed and there are portions of that that are denied, and all of a sudden we're paying for the portions that are denied, even if the main charge is found to be the person's guilty of it. And I don't think that that's the intent, but I can, by what you're explaining, I think that that would be the case. And I think that we want it very clear in statute what we mean by this partial payment or by, I'm just not reading that clearly enough. So, Mr. Chairman, I would request that we get a little more detail from the sponsor on setting that in.
You made a note of that, right?
Sure, yeah, through the representative, through the chair. That is fine. We're more than happy to work with you and members of the committee on that and see if we can provide some clarification before the next hearing.
Is there any thought of trying to get any reimbursement by the complainant for a charge where somebody is exonerated, the governor, lieutenant governor?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware of any discussion on that topic that's happened with this bill.
Because, you know, a person could bring a whole series of frivolous charges, if you will, however you define that. I guess frivolous is in the eye of the beholder or the defendant. But, you know, that could add up to a lot of money trying to defend yourself from these kinds of things. And then if you are exonerated and you're frivolous, you probably will be exonerated. Then the state is on the hook for this, and the complainant gets off scot-free. Was there any discussion in preparing the bill on that subject?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware of...
To reach assistance, press 0. To enter a breakout session, press 1. To dial a phone number or get all missing invitees...
Excellent testimony there. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I am not aware of particulars of any discussion that may have happened on that topic. Certainly, that is a huge problem, and that kind of gets to the core of a lot of this. And so, you know, I think that certainly Representative Gruenberg would like to entertain that discussion as well, but I'm not aware of.
But would you ask him his thoughts on this? It may not fit in this bill, mm-hmm. or may, mm-hmm. but I think it needs to be explored, because either the governor and lieutenant governor is going to be on the hook for this, or if this bill, in fact, makes it through the legislature, the state's going to be on the hook for it. Representative Keller.
Yeah, just to add to that a little bit and then ask a question, if I could, Mr. Chair, but I would like to, I mean, it seems like there's potential excesses that are being addressed in this bill, and that, you know, that may happen, with the lieutenant governor or the governor. And it seems like the bill, to me, is incomplete if it doesn't address what the chair just pointed out, and that is the excesses of the accusations. The question I would have on that, to line with that, is if the sponsor, Representative Gruenberg, would predict that we are in the future going to see more of the, I don't want to characterize them, but more ethics complaints, you know, frivolous or not, or you know, it has to do with why the bill is coming forward. It seems like if we don't address both aspects of it, it may not be complete. But my real question, if I might, it has to do with page 4, where the definition of exonerated down there that you were talking about.
Where then on 4?
Page 4, line 22 and following. And so I guess right now, for right now, specifically sub C on page 28, it seems like that sentence gives a disproportionate amount of power, potential power, to the courts. And it could, my question could be because I don't have any much courtroom experience, but it seems like it might be a pretty simple thing for the judge to add corrective action, therefore eliminating the possibility of being exonerated. And it just seems like it throws a lot of undue power, gives it, everybody else gives it up, and it goes to that one judge who's deciding this. And I would like if the sponsor could come back and maybe give me some insights into what happens there. What the dismissal, I noticed in the previous two sections, referred to just three statutes. And I was wondering if there's any other basis for dismissal for the exoneration. That's one part of the question. The second part of the question is how easy is it for a judge to throw corrective action on or not if he happens to want to, for whatever reason that may or may not be related directly to the case.
Representative Keller, through the chair, I certainly will talk with Representative Gruenberg about both of those issues. I wanted to clarify one of your questions, though. You said, is there any other basis for a dismissal? Could you clarify, besides what's listed here, do you mean?
Thank you, through the chair. In sub A there, it says dismissed under three statutes there.
Oh, yes.
And then under B, it's dismissed under another statute. And frankly, I have not gone back and reviewed those statutes. But is that a limiting thing? I mean, in other words, could there be dismissal based on another statute? I don't know. You know, I just would like some better understanding of that, and maybe some lights could be thrown on.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Keller, I believe that those are the only circumstances under which the case would be dismissed. However, I will look into that to make sure that that is the correct answer, and we'll answer your other questions for you, certainly.
Governor Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 3, on line 12, it says, if the event does not have a partisan political purpose and the person is transported with the governor or lieutenant governor, the state is reimbursed for the actual cost. And I'm just thinking that, can you kind of explain to me, I can see if it's in like an Alaska Airlines plane, it's really easy to figure out, okay, you know, extra seats were taken and whatever they cost, that's easy. Mm-hmm. But wonder if it's in on a state plane and two extra people were flying, it's not gonna cost any more to fly that plane, whether he's alone or with two extra people. Are they not gonna charge for that then? I mean, I kind of wonder about that type of a situation.
And an expansion on it, what about traveling in a National Guard bird or traveling in, say, a military aircraft or some military function?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I think that probably the best person to answer this is Judy Bachman from the Department of Law. I believe that there was the Attorney General several years ago answered a question on the subject, and I'm not as familiar with the opinion as she may be.
I believe that that in that situation where it's on a state-owned plane or van or whatever it may be, I think that I believe that the way they calculate it is whatever it would cost the an average citizen to take that same trip. But I will clarify that and make sure that that we know exactly what would happen in situations such as that where it doesn't cost any more for another person to be on the plane or van or whatever it may be.
And does that cover, you know, like space, a space available, or perhaps a military plane or a National Guard, you know, active duty plane or a National Guard bird? How did that work out?
I believe that would be covered as well, but again, I will I'll get clarification on that for the next hearing.
Any questions, Representative Keller?
If I might, Mr. Chair, just your presentation. I do want to make sure I understood. The Section 3 is what the Attorney General has presented as regulation, with the exception of, and the purpose for the sponsor, I heard you say, I think, to bring that forward is partly to eliminate appearance of impropriety and a question of authority or whether he had authority to do that or not. But the two things that you said the change, one was the definition of child. Mm-hmm. Would you, what was the second one, if you don't mind? I wasn't clear.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, the other change from the regulations is contained in Section 4, which is legal fees and costs. So there's only one change from the regulations in Section 3, and the other is contained in Section 4.
So if I might, Mr. Chair, the follow-up then is just that Section 3 then is nothing more than as far as the statute, any changes, is a definition of the child. And the primary purpose maybe is the eliminate the appearance of impropriety.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. On page 4, line 31, mm-hmm. Where it's talking about fees and costs, fees and related costs of legal representation that are necessarily incurred in defense. The necessarily incurred in defense, is that a term of art that's well understood as far as the necessary? I mean, obviously you are expending the funds in your defense. I mean, so they're necessarily expended for that purpose. But is the necessarily incurred, is that a term of art that limits it so that even though you're expending the funds in defense, that they are limited to minimum appropriate amount of money, or is that just saying that the expense was used in defense and doesn't relate to what a reasonable person would expend?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, necessarily incurred would basically it just makes the inquiry, are these fees reasonable or not? And it would be an industry standard compared to what are the normal fees that are incurred in defense against these types of claims. We're not going to be paying for, I don't think, extravagant client lunches and things like that through there. So there would be an inquiry, if there is any question as to whether a fee or cost was necessarily incurred, certainly the burden would be on the employee and legal counsel to prove that. But basically, we're looking at industry standards.
Reverend Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I'd like to request, because I can see this as a point of contention in future lawsuits or whatever. So what I would like to do is ask the sponsor to get a legal opinion that will accompany the packet, so we have it in the legislative history of exactly what that.
Do we know what we're talking about?
Yes. And I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions from the committee? Do you have any else? I have another person I'd like to call. Anything I'd like to say at this point?
Mr. Chairman, not right now.
Okay. Do we have Judy Bachman in the audience or online?
I'm on Chairlin?
Yes, I hear you.
Okay. This is Judy Bachman. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Department of Law here in Anchorage, and I'm the state ethics attorney, or have been for a number of years now. And I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee. Ms. Stat has summarized what I was principally going to comment on, which was the fact that we do have regulations on these two topics in place now, and there are the two differences principally that she flagged. There are other structural differences because, of course, the bill is a statute and our regs are setting standards to interpret the act. I can offer a couple of comments on questions that were asked, although we lost connection for a few minutes in the middle. Chair Lynn, you asked how much money has been incurred in defending ethics complaints and with respect right. to the governor. And I don't believe we know that number. We have no reason to know it since former Governor Palin, of course, has defended herself. And to recall, there have not been other instances where counsel has been hired for another governor or a lieutenant governor or other state officer. And it's important to always remember that we're not just talking about the governor and lieutenant governor, other than in one circumstance in the last couple of years, at least, that I've been in this position, although that was a situation where the person was not exonerated, if you will. But we don't know the number. The administration has, through its risk management system, done some representation, although I'm not sure any under the Ethics Act of state officers.
Well, obviously, it would depend on the complexity of the allegation.
Certainly, at any rate. So I don't know that we have the numbers to answer your questions about how much in the past has been spent on fees. I would say that in my experience, leaving aside Governor Palin's situation, the number of cases in which there has been defense counsel has been relatively small. Over my tenure in any case. So the chair, Representative Seaton asked a question about apportionment of the claims, and in the regulations, we require that the public officer provide clear documentation that the expenses were limited to the violation for which the officer was exonerated. And I think in the situation of review of any requests for attorney's fees, and this may answer to some extent the last question that Representative Seaton asked as well about necessarily incurred, there is, of course, a practice of review in the court system for attorney's fees requests. In addition to the comment regarding clear evidence that it relates to the exonerated claim, we expanded our regulations on what reasonable expenses necessarily incurred to include evaluation of complexity, the rate charge, the hours expended, the relationship between the amount of work performed and the significance of the claim, and certainly probably other relevant factors depending on the circumstance. So I think what is certainly contemplated is that when a person makes a claim for reimbursement or payment of their attorney's fees, the request will be examined for reasonableness to ensure that fees the word necessarily incurred in the language of both the reg and the proposed statute, and that if it's a situation where there are multiple claims and there's a basis for separating out claims on which a person has been exonerated from perhaps another violation, we'll be able to do so. But we don't have any practical experience, I guess, at this point to show that. But we've tried to set standards so it can be done. Then, so on the question to the chair that Representative Keller asked about corrective action and that section of the Act dealing with dismissal, the Act currently provides in a number of places the option to dismiss, and those are listed in A, and generally at the preliminary initial review stage, that's 310D. 320 is dismissal for finding no probable cause after an investigation, and 370D would be dismissal after a public hearing by the board, and then there's dismissal provided for under 370F, and I'm not certain that references, because I'm not aware that we've ever gotten there. The Act permits dismissal, a finding of probable cause, which would lead to accusation and hearing, but also separately under 330, a finding that, although there is a finding of violation, a hearing isn't warranted, and either corrective action or preventative action, in the words of the statute, can be imposed. And so the definition of exonerated is intended, both in the regulation and in Representative Grumberg's bill, to cover all of those situations in which we could do something other than, or end up with something other than, simply a clean dismissal and finding of no violation. And the contemplation would be these would not be available in any situation where the matter was not cleanly dismissed. That is, if we come to terms to settle on some corrective action, which is what most often happens when there's a violation, that would not mean exoneration, even though the person may not admit to a violation.
I see. You have really a terrible connection there. Are you calling from your office or?
No, I'm in the LIO. Maybe the volume, is the volume good?
Well, that's better right now.
Okay, maybe I don't have the little speaker close enough.
Okay. I made a query about the person who made the complainant sharing some of the legal costs if a person is exonerated under the standards set by this proposed legislation. Any thoughts on that?
I think you were speaking on that. I came in on the tail end when we lost connection here. We didn't look at that in the context of, as I recall, the original legal analysis and policy analysis which led to the regulations, and to some extent then Representative Gruenberg's interest in putting this in statute. The focus was on the benefit to the state that from having state offices not fear, if you will, that they will be exposed to undue fees, and wanting to ensure that someone who may be unfairly charged has the ability not to be burdened by being a state officer, and we didn't look at trying to put in place recovery for the complainants. And I don't know that actually in our role of preparing regulations we could do that because it wouldn't be interpreting current statute.
I'm just curious about that. I believe, somebody correct me if I'm wrong, isn't there something for some of the environmental lawsuits where we have that?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Just recalling past bills, we had one from, I think it was a legislator from Fairbanks that it was imposing a $5,000 fine if you filed an ethics complaint that was later dismissed, and we're going down that same line of how much chilling do we do the public to be able to file an ethics complaint if they are then going to be exposed to the state's legal fees. And I think that that was dropped in the previous legislature because of the potential for having an ethics law and then having most of the citizens of the state fearing a potential for a huge bill if later the ethics complaint was resolved in the favor of the person, that we wouldn't, the ethics law would actually be circumvented what we were trying to do, because nobody,
many people wouldn't. Everybody needs to be able to file an ethics complaint against anybody at any time without a problem. But I just wonder, you know, some of them are just clearly frivolous. Representative Peterson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Along that same line of thinking, then, a person who incurs expense to file a complaint, and that complaint turns out to be valid, they're already putting out their own money, or maybe it's a group that's come together to provide funding to file this complaint. And there's nowhere in this bill or in statute that I'm aware of where they're reimbursed for those expenses. And we're not talking about doing that here, but
I think that's a valid point. Okay. Any other comment? Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Bob. Do you have anything else that you'd like to comment on?
I could briefly comment on Representative Wilson's question about charging on the same aircraft and the opinion the staff mentioned. Early, I think 2004, 2005, there was an opinion prepared that suggested that it was inappropriate for other than a state officer on state business to be traveling on the state aircraft at state expense, and that that person, even though the cost of the flying the plane wasn't any different, there was a benefit, improper benefit, if you will, to that person, and therefore we look at the cost of the expense. And I don't want to be quoted exactly on what is done now, but I'm certain that if someone in that capacity who that is not a state officer or a state business is flying on a state aircraft, there is a reimbursement probably based on the proportionate cost, well, the cost of commercial benefit, commercial airfare. But I'm not positive exactly how to parse that out. But it was a consideration more than there's no of the benefit to the person and not just the cost or lack of increased cost to use the aircraft that led to the situation of where we are today in terms of both the regs and the statute, and considering when it may be appropriate for the state to pay for family member travel for the governor or lieutenant governor.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Any other comments?
Okay.
Thank you very much. Anybody else in the audience who would like to make any comment or online? Okay. Any other comments from the committee? If not, we're going to hold this bill. I hope Reverend Grunberg is feeling better next time around. And please feel free to have your office contact any of us on any of the matters that we discussed today. We're currently scheduled on Thursday, January 27th to hear HB 3 requirements for a driver's license, which basically requires that a driver's license expires when your passport or your visa or green card or whatever expires. So we'll be discussing that on Thursday. Currently, we don't have anything for Saturday. So any other business come before the committee? If not, I'd like to thank you for our first session of the committee this time. And we are adjourned at 9:20.